time has come today. Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel with a program about time. Not such a long time ago, time was an arbitrary measure decided by each community without consideration of other localities. In this edition of Radio Curious, we visit with Clark Blaze, author of Time Lord, Sir Sanford Fleming and the Creation of Standard Time. Although this program was recorded a long time ago in 2001, we are airing it for the first time in the last week of 2011. In the mid-19th century, with the advent of continent-spanning railroads and transatlantic steamers, the myriad of local times became a mind-boggling obstacle. The rational ordering of time, to some, became an urgent priority for transportation and commerce. Standard time was established in 1884, leading to an international uniformity for telling time. Arguably, uniformity of time was the crowning achievement of Victorian progressiveness, one of the few innovations of that time to have survived unchanged into the 21st century. Under the leadership of Sir Sanford Fleming, amid political rancor of delegates from industrializing nations, an agreement was reached to establish the Greenwich Prime Meridian passing through Greenwich, England, and the international dateline that wanders its way through the Pacific Ocean. This 1884 agreement resulted in a uniform system of worldwide time zones that exists today. I had a good time visiting with Clark Blaze in the spring of 2001 as we discussed how our current notion of time was established. We began when I asked him to explain what standard time is.
Standard time was a way of agreeing among the countries and among politically, culturally, technologically, whatever you want to call it, of agreeing on a single set, a single standard by which we would measure time. In other words, it would be measured according to Western notation.
Well, what does that mean, Western notation?
That the civil day would start at midnight, which is counterintuitive to most people in the world. For example, observant Jews and Arabs would start the day at sundown, officially marking the beginning of the day at sundown.
And that's because sundown is a time certain when most people are awake?
Yeah, and also it just makes sort of intuitive sense that God is hiding his face. You know, it makes a kind of an intuitive sense in a traditional cultures that all you needed to know, in fact, was daylight and nighttime in an agricultural community, for example.
But the development of commerce imposed a requirement for coordination.
A huge amount of coordination. Consider schedules, tariffs, contracts, and all the rest of it, sure.
So how did this come to be?
Well, the Western civil day, beginning at midnight, avoids the problems of dawn and dusk, you know, avoids the problem of sunrise and sunset. It'll always be dark when that happens, so you are not even tempted to consider the day starting with the sun or with sort of the natural appearance of the sun or the natural setting of the sun. So this is one way of breaking the hold that nature had imposed on mankind for thousands of years, and saying that man himself can sort of seize the logic, if you wish, of the day, and say that his day will begin at midnight, therefore avoiding all of the problems of summer and winter, and when the days are longer or the days are shorter, You had all the sorts of problems like that.
But still, whether the sun sets at 5 o'clock or 9 o'clock, the next day it'll be very close in time, so a day is quite close to one revolution on its axis.
Right. Well, that's the only scientifically imposed reality, is the Earth's rotation on its axis and the Earth's rotation around the sun. That there's going to be a fixed amount of time before the dawn comes around again, or before the January 1st, let's say, comes around again. It's a fixed number of days, however you want to measure the days. The days don't have to be 24 hours long. The week doesn't have to be 7 days long. The hour doesn't have to be composed of 60 minutes and the minute of 60 seconds. These are all, impositions that were built into the standard time convention or the standard time agreements.
I'd like you to explain how those impositions evolved. But before we get to that, can you explain the different kinds of time zones that there were perhaps in the United States before we had the 24 time zones around the world?
Well, before that, we didn't really have time zones as such. We had time standards, as they were called, that were...
Sounds like a newspaper.
The time standards, right? Well, we had time standards that were largely imposed by the railroads themselves, so that the railroads' running schedules became, in a sense, the time zone. So that if you were getting on the Pennsylvania Railroad in Philadelphia and running to Chicago, you stayed on Philadelphia time all the way through to Chicago. And then when you got off in Chicago, you were ready for a big surprise because it would be 2 hours earlier than your Philadelphia time. Essentially, what we're saying is that there was no time zone because every community on the Earth, on the face of the Earth, adopted solar time as its standard. So that means the sun at noon, as sort of sundial time, created your time for your particular little community. But if you went 12 miles east or 12 miles west, you would be involved in a different minute. Do you see what I mean? So that by following the sun, we were committing ourselves to an almost infinite number of times, all of which were relevant, all of which made perfectly good sense to people living within their own little bubble of 12 miles.
The 12 miles is significant to the circumference of the Earth?
Exactly.
How does that relate when you get farther north or south from the equator?
It becomes...
becomes less than 12.
Yes.
So this began to cause a problem as commerce developed in the United States.
As the speed of life picked up. The speed of life was really determined by the locomotive and by the telegraph, the two big inventions of the 1820s and 1830s.
So what happened?
As soon as you started being able to go 500 miles in a day, you were bursting through 25 different time zones. And people didn't know what time it would be when they got off their train.
And when they began to care, the paradigm was beginning to shift?
Exactly. I mean, not only beginning to care, but you had the proliferation of railroad lines, all of them adhering to the time of their headquarters. If you were coming from Philadelphia and intersecting a train that was coming out of New Orleans, the two trains would not be able to communicate the same time.
When you say the headquarters, you mean the headquarters...
The actual headquarters of the railroad company.
So what happened? People would arrive early or late and didn't know it?
Well, people had to carry a compendium with them, a correspondence book. That was a very thick, almost a traveler's Bible, that rendered equivalent times for every city and for every railroad and for every junction in the country. So that if you were getting off that Philadelphia train, say in Pittsburgh, and you were meeting another train that was coming in from St. Louis, you would have to know what the, in real time, what the St. Louis time was as opposed to the Philadelphia time. It became extraordinarily complicated. And if you receive, for example, a telegram in California sent from Pittsburgh, and it was given, and the Pittsburgh local time was given, you still had no way of knowing what time that meant. You know what it meant for you. The man, for example, who was running the weather service, the first man who created the U.S. Weather Service, was receiving a continual flow of data from about 2,000 different reporting stations all around the country. But all of those reporting stations were reporting their data in their time. So it was impossible to know, for example, if a front that was moving was really moving in at the same time between two places.
So the legacy of President Chester A. Arthur is left by the establishment of what we now know as Standard Time.
Right. It was
Tell us how that occurred.
Yeah, it was in 1883 and 1884. In 1883, the railroads in North America got together and created something like time zones, something like the 5 hours that we now have in North American railroads. You had the Pacific, the Mountain, the Central, the Eastern, and the Atlantic time zones. They were not clearly geometrically laid out the way they are today, following sort of the larger longitudinal pattern. They were rather rough-edged zones that really followed the railroad lines rather than the longitudinal marking.
The legacy of the railroad control?
This is exactly it. The railroads controlled time. The railroads were deathly afraid, however, that the government might come in and impose something on them. So they came up with this solution, which was not particularly satisfactory, but it worked in a way. And that was in 1883. But in 1884 came the larger conference called by Chester A. Arthur for Washington, D.C., the International, the Prime Meridian Conference of 1884, which was really pushed by Sir Sandford Fleming, the man who's the focus of my book, the man I call the Time Lord. He is the man who pushed for a world solution to the standard time problem. The railroads in North America didn't have to deal, after all, with a prime meridian or with an international dateline. But someone who would take on the question of standard time for the world had to take on those other questions as well.
Why was the prime meridian selected to run through Greenwich, England?
This was a political thing. 90% in the time of the 1880s, 90% of the world's shipping was really controlled by two powers, Britain and the United States. Britain through all of it, through its entire empire fleet. So that 90% of the world was already using charts based on a prime meridian, that is a zero meridian out of Greenwich, England. So that it was practical. But it was not scientific in any way. And you still had a dozen other countries in the world who were using their own prime meridians. So that if you were meeting a Brazilian boat or a French boat or a Spanish or Italian boat out on the sea, you would not be able to communicate within, just like the railroads in North America, you would not be able to communicate at sea with someone who was not using a Greenwich chart. Because their zero would be running through Paris or Cadiz or Rome or whatever it may be.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Clark Blaze, author of Time Lord, Sir Sandford Fleming and the Creation of Standard Time. This program was recorded in the spring of 2001 and first broadcast in the last week of 2011. Time is the consideration of many of us, so let's take a brief reprise and listen to a portion of Time as sung by the Chambers Brothers in the 1970s. You've just heard a portion of Time as sung by the Chambers Brothers. This is Radio Curious. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel, in conversation with Clark Blaise, author of Time Lord. Clark, when standard time was imposed, there was a 24-hour clock, and then it evolved to the 12-hour clock that we know now. Can you explain the background on that?
12-hour clock was the standard, and Sanford Fleming was very much involved in the 24-hour clock. So he wanted the 24-hour clock. In fact, it was the existence of the 12-hour clock that got him started 12 years earlier in the whole question of standard time, because he had missed his train, because there had been a misprint in that big, thick traveler's guide to the railroads that had put a 5:30 p.m. departure at 5:30 a.m. So since he missed his train, he started asking himself, why do we have these 12-hour phases? Are we so stupid that we can't keep a 24 hours in mind? And so he's the one who started his time revolution, or his standardization program, based on the 24-hour clock. And so the 24-hour clock was, in fact, adopted at the Prime Meridian Conference as well. And that's why you have the 24-hour clock more or less used around the world, except in the United States. I mean, if you talk about we'll leave it 1750 or something, you say that quite easily in Europe, but you don't say it here.
Why is that?
I think America is a very conservative country, and is the legacy certainly of its isolation from the rest of the world. It felt it never had to do it. It's the same kind of isolation that refuses to adopt the metric system, whereas everyone else in the world has it. We are still using a British imperial measure, the only country to do so. Sometimes the great disaster, such as the Mars lander, if you remember once, and we got confused with pounds of fuel and kilos of fuel.
And how much was on board, and would they make it?
It was a terrible disaster. I mean, we would have had a perfect Mars landing, except for some fool not making the proper conversions.
You have an interesting analogy with movies in your book, Movies as to Time and Prime Meridians in a Movie.
Yeah, when I was a kid in Pittsburgh, my parents were working all the time. They had a little store, and so I was free to go to the movies after school, and I would do it just about every night. And, in those days, the movies ran continually. You just sort of walk into the movie. And the idea of actually waiting for the movie to start was a kind of a bizarre idea to me. You'd walk in the middle, and you would catch up with the movie. And you would stay until you had come into the part where you had entered. And that is the analogy I use to standard time. That is, the Earth is continually rotating, and it doesn't matter when or where you would, say, establish a zero meridian. It could be Yokohama, it could be Ukiah, it could be New York, it could be anywhere. Because in 24 hours, as we call them hours, in those 24 hours, it'll come back again to the same place. The Earth's rotation means that every longitude passes under the sun once a day. And when the second rotation comes, that's the end of the day. And that's the way movies were. It was a simple analogy to draw, but it was one that I thought was quite maybe useful for people of my age, at least, who remembered that experience. And it was the kind of thing that nowadays we go to movies very, very much on the Greenwich model. We all wait until the opening, and the idea of actually even being allowed to sit through the movies, to sort of sit there in your seat and stay all day, would not be permitted.
You have to pay again.
You have to pay again. So that, you know, that we're having it's a different world.
Let's look at time in relationship to the calendar change, changing from 2002 to 2003, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That's just an artificial placement.
Yes, yes. For example, even a 7-day week, 7 days as a week is artificial. It comes from the Bible. I mean, it is a hangover from the imposition of the biblical creation story, and it was also part of the Roman and Greek notions that there were seven visible heavenly bodies, each of them inhabited, let's say, by a god. You had the sun, the moon, and then the five visible planets. So seven became embedded as the notion of a week. But the idea of 52 weeks, the idea of 7 days in a week, the idea of 24 hours in a day, all of these things are arbitrary. And various other cultures have other numbers to deal with. When the revolution came in France, they wanted to decimalize time and, in fact, to get it away from the idea of religion. So they made the 20-hour day, the 50-week year. They had the 100-minute hour.
And currently, where approximately 25% of the people on Earth live, in China, they use a lunar calendar.
Well, of course, the lunar calendar is used also by Muslims. That's how, and by Jews. These are how, and we have only one hangover and that's the Easter. That's why Easter is why we can't fix it as a single date each year.
Well, it's predicted off of the lunar cycles being the Sunday after the first full moon after the spring equinox.
So there you are. it's still really our only inheritance, let's say, from an earlier worldview.
Clark, you mentioned briefly the importance of solar eclipses. Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, the solar eclipse for the 19th century scientist was a great magical moment. First of all, it was a gathering point where all the astronomers would meet, knowing where they had to be at any given time. The great solar eclipse of 1869 was in South India. That was the best point. And it allowed people who were experimenting with cameras to take pictures of the solar flares during the time of optimum eclipse, and then analyze the starlight, the sunlight, spectrographically for its chemical makeup. Now, this was considered in the 19th century almost the epitome of scientific advancement, of scientific modernity, if you wish, to be able to say that something that is millions of miles away is composed because of the analysis that you can make of the light is composed of certain chemicals. This was a remarkable demonstration of science, I think, that was open to even unscientific minds were beginning to see how important it was. And also, of course, the fact that it was a place in which scientists could meet and discuss their ideas. And in fact, all of the people who were major movers of the Standard Time movement in 1884 were, in fact, together in Madras, India in 1869.
As well as being able to predict the moment of the solar eclipse.
Yes. Yeah, that had been, of course, predictable many, many years. I mean, even in Newtonian physics, they could make predictions about when there would be eclipses. This is not that difficult for people who know how to do it, but taking it to the next step was something new.
Clark, you describe Standard Time as a watershed moment in history. What do you mean?
The moment in which mankind took control of time for its own purposes, for technology, for business, for the arts, for the sciences, is a watershed moment because it was taking it away from the priests, the druids, the Bible, and other kinds of natural controls, so that what had always been considered to be larger than man, that is, the fates almost, suddenly became under man, fell under man's control. And we simply said, it doesn't matter it doesn't matter what the seasons are, it doesn't matter what's light and dark, many things don't matter. What really matters is our own convenience. And once we established a kind of harmony, a temporal harmony, we were able then to coordinate so many, many more things. That is, it would be impossible to have computers without standard time, be impossible to have any of our contracts and any of kinds, of course, of our businesses, any kinds of, down the line, it all depends on an agreed upon standard.
Which is so agreed upon that everyone knows when it is and what it means to be on time.
Exactly, exactly. And no one knew what it meant to be on time even 125 years ago. To be on time meant you had to ask a second question. What time are we talking? Are you talking about solar time, or are you talking about the Pennsylvania Railroad time? What time are you talking about? And cities like Buffalo or cities like St. Louis had six different official times. Buffalo had three times. St. Louis had six official times.
Well, Clark Blaze, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
It's a book called The Time of Our Singing by Richard Powers. Wonderful. It's a huge book about American race, but also about science, physics, and it's a novel, and music. It's only Richard Powers, I think, who's the author of some exquisite works, could have come up with something as daunting as this and yet as readable and as human as this.
Well, Clark Blaze, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry.
This interview with Clark Blaze, author of Time Lord, Sir Sanford Fleming, and the Creation of Standard Time, was recorded in the spring of 2001 and first broadcast in the last week of 2011. The book that Clark Blaze recommends is Time of Our Singing by Richard Powers. All editions of Radio Curious are free for anyone, anywhere, to listen, download, and enjoy. There are about 400 archive editions on our website, www.radiocurious.org. You may subscribe to our podcast at our website. Our email is curious@radiocurious.org. Snail mail is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. Christina Onestad is the associate producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.